Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of the Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a nonprofit living laboratory for accelerating social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about the sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I am so pleased to welcome Daniel Werenfennig as my guest on Making Change. Daniel is the co-founder and executive director of the Olive Tree Initiative on the campus of the University of California at Irvine. Back in 2007, Daniel joined together with other students and faculty members at UC Irvine to explore how to reduce the tensions between pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian groups on campus. Realizing the power of firsthand knowledge, in 2008, the group traveled to the Middle East, meeting with people of diverse viewpoints and experiences, from academics and politicians to religious authorities, community leaders, and activists on all sides of the issues. In the years since that initial visit, the Olive Tree Initiative has evolved into a full-blown experiential learning program that promotes both conflict analysis and conflict resolution. The goal of the program is not to change students' allegiances. It's instead to help students better negotiate and resolve conflicts of all kinds. Daniel's work prior to founding the Olive Tree Initiative has also aimed at global conflict resolution, whether he was focusing on the situations in Kosovo or Northern Ireland, or connecting young Germans with young Israeli Jews to create connection and healing. Given the depth of his experience with an issue that is so critical to creating change, resolving conflict, and forming connection, it is my pleasure to have Daniel Werenfennig share his observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Daniel Werenfennig with the Olive Tree Initiative. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
It's really my pleasure to have you here. Everything that you are working on is just so timely and has been, I guess it has been for decades. I'm curious about if you could share with our listeners the path that has led you to the work that you're doing. If you could talk a little bit about the work you're doing, but also what led you to this?
So the Olive Tree Initiative, what I'm currently doing is a program that is based on 11 campus chapters right now around the United States, one in London. And we're bringing students into conflict zones and teach them through experiential learning more the complexity of conflicts and how to solve them and develop tools and innovative ways to deal with them. The background, how that all started for myself, I have to go back quite a little bit, is I grew up in Germany, was always very interested in international politics and anything happening in the international arena, but then had the opportunity early on in the early 90s to be part of what's called a third generation dialogue, German-Jewish dialogue, that brought me to Israel to meet with the third generation, meaning the generation. So my grandfather was born and was alive in the time of the Second World War. My father was just born after, and I'm the third generation. So the idea of this dialogue was to bring together people of this third generation, talk about history and what it meant to growing up in a society with the effects that have lived with the effects of the terrible times of the Second World War. And obviously being on different sides as somebody being German or somebody being Jewish, Israeli Jewish, being more part of the victims or part of the perpetrator in that sense. Wow. Wow. And so I learned a lot through that by talking to people, Holocaust survivors, people who, you know, were in concentration camps and others. But there was also time in the Middle East itself when a lot of positive things were going on. The peace process was going very well, and a lot of dialogue groups, how they were called back then, today it's a challenging word, were going on, and Palestinians and Israelis would sit together for the first time very often, learn about each other, about their background, about the similarities and differences, and it was just magic to experience that. And so I had the opportunity to see the transformative power of people really coming together and working through their differences and kind of getting to know each other and diving into this complexity of a conflict in their lives and a society, and then developing strong bonds and sometimes friendships and working relationships to really working on peace. And then later on, that kind of interest network continued, and I spent some time in the Kosovo after the first Yugoslavian war, helping with programs there. and also saw the negative effects of war and how important it is for outsiders to be helpful, to bring people in communication with each other again, and the lack of communication, the lack of actually people meeting each other was very evident there. I know it's a lot of stories.
Wow. So what led you from there, from working, doing this wonderful third generation dialogue and then the work that you were doing in Kosovo, what led you to founding the Olive Tree Initiative?
So what led me to it is then from starting the third generation dialogue, or were involved in that, was then later on, I was also working in the United States Congress for some time as an intern when 9/11 happens, which was also very transformative in many ways. And I asked the congressman back in the day and said, I want to be involved in international politics. Mm-hmm. What do I have to do? And he said, you have to get a PhD in that field to learn the tools. And also, it's still a very expert-driven environment. And you need to have this PhD to be an expert and to do that. And so I came to the United States then, getting a PhD in political science, international relations. And in that time, when I was researching, because of my background and interest in the Middle East and also Europe, and specifically Northern Ireland, I was looking into citizen dialogue, the role of citizen in peace building. There was a lot of activism on the campus I chose, UC Irvine, around the Israeli-Palestinian question conflict, with groups, very strong mobilization on student groups and community on either side. What I experienced was that a lot of that, which is very positive for me as a European to see how many people are involved in that kind of work, but I felt it was also very polarizing and that people were not much interested or connected to the complexity and the realities of what was going on the ground. Right. So what led me to then was to encourage students, I was myself a graduate student and faculty, and challenge them to say, to come up with an idea of to build a trip together with people from different perspectives, different backgrounds on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to go to the conflict itself and learn more about the realities on the ground in order to ground the conversation and discussions we had really in the realities and to come up with innovative ways to move forward.
Wow. When was this going on? When was that first trip that you guys made?
The first trip was in 2008. We started in 2007. Students came together with faculty and myself and others, and we came up with this idea. We had to fundraise. We had to start from scratch. We had to overcome all of these challenges of parents and our campus and people not really particularly fond of sending students into a conflict zone.
Right.
They had to overcome the issues of people from very different backgrounds and opinions of where you go, what to see, what about security, how many soldiers on the bus, what you have to do to get people moving, and how to create, quote unquote, a balanced itinerary so that every group, everybody felt that their voices, their perspectives were heard and seen. So they felt really at the ability to communicate strongly to everybody else what they wanted them to see.
Wow. And how many trips have you made since then?
There have been six student trips, six wow. trips where we took students from various campuses. After 2 years, we grew out of Irvine to other campuses and then took delegations from these campuses in as well. Then there had been two community trips I had led myself to with some of the supporters of the students who were then were so interested as well. But we did not want to get community members and students on the same trip. They different ideas of how to spend their time.
Sure, yeah. That absolutely leads to the question that really guides this interview show, which is, in all of the perspectives that you've had, starting back with the third generation dialogues, looking at the work that you've done over time, and now through the Olive Tree Initiative, when you see change happening, what do you see supporting that change? What do you see are the factors that are really creating change?
I think there's a number of factors. I think from my own work, when I look at change on a society level, how to move and how to have a successful peace process, I found in studying, for particular, the Northern Ireland conflict and its successful involvement of citizens in that, there are five principles that I found that are really important for the success. And that was that the efforts that people had were strategic, that the groups, especially the citizens involved, had strong links to the political decision makers, mm-hmm. that the communication within the groups or within the different levels of society, as well as between the groups, were ongoing meaning you don't stop talking, you don't stop engaging each other when times become hard and tough, which normally happens in a conflict again and again, mm-hmm. that there was an element of proactive engagement before problems become even bigger, and then that groups were also much more inclusive about the process and letting others from outside in and continue to search to increase the realm of people affected.
So you said that you found this in Northern Ireland as well as the Middle East.
At the beginning, but then the Middle East, that's why it's kind of set up as a pair. My long-term findings was that to look at the other side in the Middle East, while a lot of these elements were there in the early peace process, when it comes to these 5 points mentioned, a lot of the conversation in the Middle East is, instead of linking it separate, meaning the political level and the civil society are not really in conversation with each other very well.
Gotcha.
They're really very distrustful, and there are various reasons for it I can elaborate. Communication is sporadic. You only talk when things are going well. That's why we see in the 90s a lot of dialogue groups, a lot of communication going on, a lot of positive things. But today there's hardly any communication between the two sides anymore. More reactive than proactive. As things go wrong, people then try to respond instead of ahead of a time. And on a bigger issue, because of a different way how money and support was distributed to groups and the process itself, the whole process was much more innovative than strategic. So people, in order to continue to receive money for, in the end, a failed process, they reinvented the ideas they had again and again. There was not a strategic long-term plan or a long-term vision for change, different from Northern Ireland, where the European Union took over a lot of these long-term visions to move the process from multiple groups working together towards a sustainable peace.
You know, that's so interesting because there is in the entire social change arena globally, no matter what the issue is, the big hot buzzword is social innovation. We're looking for innovation, 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 innovation. And it really is interesting to look at it from a different context of saying long-term strategic is really what bears out. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I'm always for innovation because society changes, but it has to be in a framework of a long-term strategic ideas. What we see, and that's kind of looking at more peace and conflict studies, that in order to change society, in particular when it comes to conflict, to bring a society again together that has been divided or to forge relationships between enemies, it sometimes takes as double at a time to have been divided to bring them together. So it's not something you can fix in a year or two or four or five. The problem is that a lot of the innovative models are very short-term models. They're very donor-driven. They're very kind of result-driven. You want to see results within the half a year, a year to continue the funding. But we know about relationships. It's a long, long-term issue. And some of the things that's in Northern Ireland, and I think that goes links back with the work we do with the students here, the peacemaker, the change makers in Northern Ireland were people who got to know each other during their diaspora studies in the United Kingdom. That was the first time that, you know, Catholics, Protestants, or Loyalists and Nationalists got to know each other and forged this early relationship, had these early talks about change. And then 10, 20, 30 years later, when they were in positions of power, of influence in their society, then it panned out, these relationships. So it's
wow.
A long cycle and look that has to start very, very early on. And that brings back to my thesis work into what we do right now with the Olive Tree Initiative, and where we see a major lack and a major difference to Northern Ireland, in particular, but when it comes to the Middle East, to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I need to elaborate on that. When I interviewed hundreds of activists, on the political level, civil society level, about why they got involved in the work they do, how they changed, what was important, many of them came back to the point of saying, you know, it was these relationships built early on in their career. In Northern Ireland, told me all these stories of falling in love, finding somebody else. And most of the time that happens in being far apart, mm-hmm. you know, their society, where the societies were really divided. You couldn't really meet somebody on the other side if it was not in, you know, conflict or altercation.
Right.
So it had to be somewhere else. And when I asked that same questions to especially people in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, who all spoke perfect English when I interviewed them, and said, well, you speak so great English, A, why? And they said, well, we studied mostly in America, in the UK, or in American institution in the Middle East. And then when I asked them if they had a chance to talk to people of different background opinion, you know, on that issue, you know, 80% said no.
Wow.
And that is something that I found at the campuses here, where people have the ability to meet each other, to have these critical conversation, to discuss the differences, to really work with each other, but also get to learn the other's perspective, this idea of compassion, not in the sense of becoming friends ultimately, but of at least learning to think from another perspective in order to work on innovation and solution, is tremendous by the amount of people from the Middle East, from these various perspectives we have. But the reality is they all, for most of the time, spend just time in separate parts of the campus and are very divided and only come together for events or having debates, not really in the way that it's a debate, but more screaming at each other.
Not constructive.
Not constructive in ways. And then in a sense, we are adding more to the problem than being part of the solution, of the potential of solution, knowing that a lot of these people, a lot of our students in 10, 20, 30 years will be major decision makers here in the United States, or even many of them back in the Middle East again.
You're really talking about the basics of people getting involved in their own conflict resolution. And it really doesn't matter if we're talking Middle East or if we're talking the horrific political state in the United States at this time, or we're talking about gang members in a community, that when we're talking about deep-seated rivalries, it really doesn't matter. A lot of what I'm hearing and what you're saying is that just because folks are near each other doesn't mean that they're going to take advantage of the opportunity to have those conversations, that it takes both someone, some party, some neutral party to bring folks together to convene that conversation and to create a neutral environment in which that can happen.
And more than that, it needs a lot of strategy and thinking on the side of who does that.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, sometimes worse than no peace process is a failed one, meaning you break that down, sometimes worse than no interaction is failed interaction. So just bringing them together from the very beginning when we started the All of Tree Initiative, it was clear that we'd not just want to put half of the group who would self-identify them as being pro-Israeli or half who would identify themselves as pro-Palestinian, which is very important that we let people identify themselves without us telling them what they are. We made sure that a third of the group was a neither nor. People who were just interested. So you didn't set up the whole process in a polarity, bipolarity from the very beginning, but set us up much more in a conversation among different people, different constituency. And then the word education, I think, plays a very, very important role. I think in order to discuss any change, and the positive thing about these issues in our campuses, there's a lot of passion, and passion means interest, which, as I tell you as a professor, today hardly any students is really passionate for anything, but good grades, and even that, you know, is disputable. That passion, however, has to be channeled in education. So we have now 30 weeks of education about anything they need to know, and they have to learn to discuss, to express themselves, to learn to speak a language. I don't mean English, a language where you translate what you want to say in a way that somebody coming from a different background really understands what you're saying. To really have a safe space, safe environment to test these things out and then go through this experience. We go for 3 weeks to the Middle East, for example, stop in Washington, D.C., meet with people in the government, main negotiators in the White House, State Department, to get the American perspective, not the California perspective, and go over. And we meet 70 to 80 speakers, from government official to parents who lost their children, to students, to anyone, to get this broad perspective. So it's a very detailed way how we also plan the engagement in the Middle East, not just where we go and what we see, but also who we meet and what we hear from them, to really expose the students to this complexity, but then also have a method after a long day of 4, 5, 6 meetings to come together in the evening from what we call reflection, where the students are guided and have been trained to express what they thought, their feelings, their differences, while speakers are challenged to tell us more, are not challenged in their positions. Then the students have this critical conversation with each other about what they thought was wrong or right or misguided or very convincing, and learn as much from each other than they do actually learn from speakers and the engagement with people there.
And what happens once that trip is over?
Very good question. At the beginning, it started just with a trip. And we thought we have to see what happens afterwards. We did not.
I love the fact that you've added this degree of intensive, complex education beforehand. It's one of those interesting things that happens when we're looking at community work. It doesn't matter again where, is that assumption that, well, we'll just go in, we'll experience it, and that's all we really need is to just be authentic in the community without having that deep education beforehand. It's wonderful that you're doing that.
And it's also important to build on something because it serves as a frame of reference to the experience. Because I think we have students that come from these areas. And I talk a lot about the Middle East, but we're also doing now Turkey, Armenia is another area we engaged in. But we have a lot of students who come from these conflict areas and have lived there for some part of their families are, and they're very emotionally involved.
Right.
And then when emotions are really high and they're important in feelings, it's important to have this educational framework to kind of plug the emotions in again and have a way to deal with it. But when they come back, there are a couple of things. We ask the students, again, to find their voice after such an intense experience. From your note, from alumni, it takes you years and continues probably your whole life to process all the things you saw and experienced. But you have to find your voice. So we ask students in ways to give a presentation in front of supporters and others, a couple hundred people every year, to give a speech. And they're really free to say what they like to say, but they have to put it in words.
Wow.
So it's very important to find your own voice in this complexity. And we ask them to write, we publish their voices in a journal article, to use a different form, more academic than, not just to have a voice in the story, but link it to arguments, link it to references, link it to these existing frameworks again to kind of put their voice in this different way, and then continue to go with them out in the community, in different communities, if it's a mosque, a synagogue, or a retirement home, or if it's a class, to share and then get different feedback from the audience and see how they respond and how they have to kind of learn to translate again all the experience into words and the ways to communicate strong. So there's a whole set of all of that. And then lastly, which was something we learned in the later years of the organization, we also want to channel all of this learning, as you mentioned earlier. They are not just particular about this conflict. They are like life lessons. And so we asked the students to channel their leadership and their experience into work with other organizations. So we give them, find ways now that the organization is also an academic program and get credit for. We give them a course with gross credit to plug into non-governmental organizations outside of the campus to take leadership and take the experiences they have on these trips and all of that into another kind of work on another topic to show them how to translate all of this, what went through with what they went through, into a different context.
So what are you finding? What's coming out of all of this? Because first of all, it just sounds fascinating and so well thought out. And I love the fact that it's not thought out of, oh, we have this idea and this is what it must look like, that you're on a learning experience here as well, that you're learning as you go and seeing what has to happen next. What's coming out of all of that? What are you seeing?
It's again a very positive thing to be in a university where we have the leading experts and finding out what's going on. So from the very beginning, we involved graduate students and professors into studying our own work. So we have really, really good data on what happens with the students through the program. So we obviously, as expected, we find a very, on a short-term level, big motivation. But now the program started in 2008. We're tracking our alumni. So what that means is that we also not just find it's on a short-term mobilization, long-term. Mm-hmm. On kind of data, 60 to 70% of our students kind of change their subject based on that experience into want to be involved in something more internationally or even conflict resolution work, which again, this is not we are an experiential learning program. Conflict resolution is just one of the outcomes of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw much activism. We see a lot of empowerment. So we, for example, ask the question, how comfortable are you to teach a course or 1 hour lessons on these subjects before, after, long term? See a lot more empowerment of the students in itself. We see that the students, their ability to engage complexity, to deviate their own opinion from their group's opinion, to qualify their group's opinion, to translate in other words, in ways what they want to say, is unbelievable to see the change before and after this experience and see how that empowers them to really apply these same lessons, not just to the particular area that just studied, if it's the Middle East and now Turkey, Armenia, but also in other life situations, as you mentioned, gang membership, personal problems in their family, mm-hmm. skills like active listening, skills like how to conceptualize complexity and communicate better, that is very, very strong. And going back to my PhD studies, I'm looking forward to see how in now, give it another 6-7 years, how many of these students, of these 100 alumni, are plugging in internationally in these networks and how their relationship with each other are continuing to be a force of change and inspiration for the work they do in different conflicts or different other social challenges around the world.
So really what you're doing is you're facilitating the change in the change makers. You are looking at that whole generation of folks who are in school, giving them the opportunity to really sort of blow out the cobwebs in their brains of whatever they thought it was going to be and really become active change makers.
Yeah. Our mission statement reads in that way. It's like to promote, you know, rigor, critical thinking through experiential education. That's our tool. And so the idea is to give people really the background, the training, the tools that are important and necessary for them to develop innovative and better ways to resolve conflicts. And when we say conflicts, that's on purposely a broader term, as it does not just apply to the one conflict they engage them at the moment, but to just other conflicts they will engage in their life too. So it is giving these early amazing students, we've worked on some of the top universities in the United States, which arguably are one of the top universities in the world, mm-hmm. with incredible, talented, incredible students with a lot of potential, but we help them really to get them out of that stagnation and out of that complexity and complacency that we see very often, unfortunately, these days, unlocking their potential into becoming change makers and make it practically and seeing them having success, short-term success of that, but also giving them a network and giving them the tools to continue to stay in contact with others so that the learning doesn't end when they graduate after 4 years of undergraduate education.
It is really fascinating in listening to you and in listening to some of the other folks that I've had on the program. Andy Carvin spoke about a year ago about the fact that he is a Twitter journalist for NPR and talked about what was going on during the Arab Spring and the fact that everybody was talking about it was a Twitter revolution. And he said, no, it's people who make the revolution. And you're really talking about not just citizen involvement, but what do citizens have to know to create the kind of change that they want to create? And I'm just so glad that you could be with us today, Daniel. I've learned so much from you, and I could ask you questions for the next 2 hours and learn so much. I'm so, so glad that you were able to be with us today. Thank you so much for sharing everything you're doing, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you for having this fantastic program and telling others about it. And thank you for offering others the opportunities to, you know, listen to many of your other guests, where I learned a lot. Listen to it. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Listening to Daniel, I'm struck by a facet of social change work that we don't often talk about, the nuts and bolts of what it takes to create productive conversation. Social change advocates talk a lot about engaging conversation, about bringing people together. But as Daniel points out, it's not enough to just bring together people, especially if they come from deeply entrenched and opposing views. Any of us who have been at parent-teacher meetings where a contentious issue is being addressed will recognize the situation that Daniel noted. Just because different groups are near each other doesn't mean their conversations will be anything more than yelling more loudly and more often at each other. Regardless of the issue, creating a better future requires everyone working together towards that future, which means that we must have productive ways of talking with each other and learning from each other. Daniel talked about several preconditions to such constructive conversation. He talked about the need for a safe, neutral space for those conversations, and the need for someone to bring people together with the intent that they'll learn from each other and get to know one another as people. Daniel also talked about the skills needed for ensuring these conversations don't devolve into shouting matches. Skills in facilitation. Skills in conflict analysis, not just conflict resolution. Skills in reflection. Sharing what we're learning, so that we learn not only from a purported expert, but from each other. And then once the experience has occurred, whether that experience is a trip to the Middle East or a facilitated dialogue among neighbors, there's the need for giving language to what has transpired. It is one thing for the attendees of an event to feel better afterward. It's a very different thing
for those individuals to be able to articulate what they learned so that the effect of that one event can ripple beyond just the immediate participants. Which leads to questions for your own work. What would it make possible for your work if everyone at every level had facilitation skills? What would board meetings look like if your board chair had facilitation skills, actively facilitating conversation and decisions? If everyone from program leaders to the receptionist to the CEO was skilled in listening and sharing and learning and reflecting, what would your work environment look like and feel like? What would your community look like and feel like? And what results might you be able to achieve in your community that you haven't been able to achieve before? Second, to what degree are you acting as a community convener? What opportunities might you have for bringing people together and facilitating conversation in a safe, neutral environment? If that became a key role of your organization, what might that make possible for your community? And lastly, what opportunities does your organization provide for experiential learning? If one of the keys to your mission is advocacy, what might it make possible if you were able to provide a more experiential link between your organization's issues and those you wish to influence? For example, if your mission is related to poverty, what might you be able to accomplish if you provided experiential learning opportunities for your board, for your donors and funders, for your legislators, for your community overall? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hildy Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hildy Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.